This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 28th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin, host of the Breaker.News podcast and publisher of the Breaker.News. Welcome to edition number 454. Happy Almost Canada Day and happy Almost 4th of July. We are almost halfway through FIFA World Cup, hosted by Vancouver and 15 other cities across North America. One of the people who looks closely at mega events around the world and around Cascadia is Portland, Oregon's Jules Boykoff. Jules Boykoff is a former U.S. national team soccer player. He is now a political science professor at Pacific University and author of several books examining mega events. And he is on the advisory board of Reboot FIFA, a UK-based campaign to reform FIFA. Boykoff's latest is called Red Card, the 2026 World Cup, Sports Washing, and the FIFA Greed Machine. He points to the original bid book for United States, Canada, and Mexico, submitted to FIFA in 2018 under the banner of United Bid 2026. Because of Donald Trump's trade war, there is anything but unity at the top levels of the three host countries. As Boykoff has written, FIFA and Trump have worked hand in hand to siphon the joy out of the World Cup, and they have turned the World Cup into an uncompromising greed machine, set on wringing every last morsel of cash from host city communities and ticket-purchasing fans alike, as well as a staging ground for Trump's dictatorial yearnings. We have seen pockets of joy in Boston with the Tartan Army, the fans of Scotland. We've seen some joy on the streets of Vancouver with the Canadian fans before Canada's two World Cup matches at BC Place. But there's still Donald Trump in the White House, in the Oval Office, saying that he doesn't need Canada for anything, even while this tournament goes on. Now, there's 3 weeks left in this tournament, Jules. What happens after July 19th, after Donald Trump is there in New Jersey to hand the trophy over to the champion and stand on the same stage and bask in the glory? What comes after July 19th for these three countries and for FIFA and soccer?
Well, first, I mean, of course, the World Cup is an amazing event in itself in terms of a spectacle of sport. And no one ever thought that FIFA and Donald Trump would be able to siphon all the joy from this event. I mean, I happen to be a massive soccer fan and dedicated a pretty big part of my life to trying to play it at a somewhat high level. And we were not, people like me, were not going to just let them steal the joy. We were going to enjoy these matches. So there's no surprise there. I mean, if you want to talk about after the World Cup, I mean, that there's a lot to be done before we get there. But I would say that, you know, we're going to be placed with what we were always placed with. That is usually debt, displacement, figuring out how to deal with displaced populations, and a more militarized, intensely policed city in terms of the host city. I mean, that's kind of what these events always bring, and sort of the bad taste of greenwashing in your mouth as well, once you kind of realize that those big sustainability promises that they promised on the front end are actually not going to actually come through when it comes to the reality of the event.
Now, the people who have gone to World Cup matches, not only here in Vancouver, but around North America, have had to deal with the FIFA ticketing website. And when you go to the FIFA ticketing website, plastered around the page are all these buttons and links saying, you know, to go and check out the hospitality tickets. They really want to upsell ticket holders into another level, which is dealing with another company called On Location, which is part of a bigger company out of New York called TKO Group. They own WWE, they own UFC. And if you look closely at that company, executives, board, and shareholders, there's a lot of friends of Donald Trump involved. And they said in stock market filings that they already banked more than $500 million before this tournament started of revenue. And what does this say about the business model for the game in North America, that they do appear to be having high occupancy of stadiums, very few empty seats despite the concerns, but they have priced out a lot of people who really have only one option, which is either to turn on the TV at home or go to one of the watch parties around their city, that this is really created a bit of a chasm. Soccer is supposed to be the people's game, but the people that are really truly enjoying it inside the stadiums seem to be more or less the 1%.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable what we've seen here in terms of the ticketing, especially in the United States, where the dynamic pricing model is running free. And of course, dynamic sounds nice. It's dynamic pricing. I like dynamic stuff, don't you, Bob? But it's not nice when you're trying to buy a ticket and basically dynamic means that FIFA is trying to extract every last dime out of you. And, you know, I have to say that when you look at the situation with the greed of FIFA, it's just off the charts this time. And it's a political question. I mean, in Mexico, they decided that resale tickets would not be able to be legally sold above the face value of the ticket. Obviously, that's not the same thing as what's happening in my home country, where it's a free for all. I mean, I saw a ticket selling online at one point for $11 million on the secondary market. FIFA loves that. Of course, they're raking it in through the primary market, but the secondary market, they're taking 15% from the buyer and 15% from the seller. So if somebody were to sell the ticket to the final for $11 million, FIFA would walk away with well over $3.5 million. They'd be doing quite well out of the deal. So they love this kind of thing. But you're right. Everyday people, everyday soccer fans get priced out. I mean, it is so hard to buy a ticket to the third U.S. match. You're going to pay thousands of dollars just for a nosebleed seat at this point. Thousands of dollars for a ticket. I mean, who realistically can do that? And, you know, Bob, you're pointing to a really important element that a lot of people, quite frankly, miss about how sports washing works. I mean, you talked about my book with the title Sports Washing in it. And sports washing is when political leaders use sports to appear important or legitimate on the world stage and to deflect attention from chronic social problems or human rights woes at home, and also set up political opportunities, economic opportunities like the ones you're pointing out right now, and diplomatic opportunities. A lot of people miss that whole second part, but you're on it. So this whole hospitality ticketing thing is relatively new. And it's a way of squeezing money out of ticket buyers, but also it's for that 1% that you mentioned, Bob, so they don't have to deal with the hoi polloi like you and me that might just have only paid $2,000 for our ticket. I mean, they want to be separate from us, physically, geographically separate from us. And that's what that's all about, extracting profit. So what does Trump get out of it after the 19th? He has all these deals, like you're pointing to, with his cronies who are set up to benefit individually, economically from this. I mean, this is the grifty 250. We're in the middle of the 250-year anniversary of the United States right now. And President Trump is showing that the grift is all about the sports, too. I mean, he has long been clinging to sports as a sort of political life raft, long been interested in sports, and long been testing the theory that he could be more politically effective by being less explicitly political. And sports very much allows him to do that.
Don Garber is in the last months of his job as commissioner. He's going to be retiring, and he's looking at a big payday for the league, because he wants more soccer-specific stadiums, more revenue out of those stadiums. And if this FIFA ticketing pricing model actually holds and goes forward into other sporting events, other soccer events, then the fans who are the diehard fans of the Vancouver Whitecaps, the Southsiders especially, might be looking at fewer affordable tickets going forward in the future if Vancouver does have in its future down the road a smaller soccer-specific stadium. So the legacy of this tournament from a business standpoint, charging more people to watch the game, could actually backfire and harm the ability of people in these three countries to enjoy the sport they love.
Yeah, while also cracking up one of the best rivalries in soccer, certainly in North America, the Vancouver-Seattle-Portland rivalry. I mean, if Vancouver left for Las Vegas, that would be an epic tragedy from a historical perspective for soccer lovers in the country. And you're right. I mean, you know, the people from MLS under Don Garber and FIFA are sort of a piece. I mean, let's spell out the business model here that you know so well that's happening in FIFA. And a lot of the mentalities get transferred to the domestic league, such as the MLS, Major League Soccer. And the basic model that FIFA brings to the table is they socialize all the costs. So they socialize security, they socialize the medical teams on the ground, they socialize all the people who are getting people to the games, the transportation is socialized, the fan fests are socialized. All of those things are very difficult for governments to monetize. What do they privatize? They privatize the of course, the broadcast money all comes into FIFA. The corporate sponsor money all comes into FIFA. They're taking the money for on-site concessions at BC Place and elsewhere. They're taking in the parking at these places. I mean, all of that is monetized for FIFA. So this model is just like so bent in favor of FIFA. This transfers this mentality to places, owners of Vancouver. I mean, I've been following the owners of Vancouver, and rarely do you have people who are owners of a sports team so boldly advertise their incompetence. They're like, we can't possibly run this as a business. We are such ineffective business people that we need actually more of your money to make it work. I mean, that's my interpretation of it. But I just think it's kind of pathetic what they've been doing. Obviously, they're not trying to say that they're bad at business, but they're trying to say it's a structurally impossible position for those poor rich people to be in. But you know what? This could be a time. If we're spending all this money anyways, Vancouver, $1 million maybe on this World Cup, and you know, of course, you combine the federal payments for this World Cup, is also another $1 billion or so, more than a billion. You could pretty much make it a public team, Vancouver, and you could have all the profits that came through the Vancouver Whitecaps go into programs in the city of Vancouver where people need it. I mean, you're already paying tons of money to these folks. You might as well get the rewards as well on the backside. I know I'm talking like radical stuff here, but it seems like in this moment when we're just getting stuck in these ruts of thinking when it comes to handing money hand over fist to these billionaires and just, you know, bowing to their every whim, that maybe we need to start thinking outside the box. What if Vancouver became the public team? That could be tremendously popular. I mean, I know I'm from Wisconsin, where we have the Green Bay Packers, and we don't have those big billionaire owners. And so when the Green Bay Packers need to raise capital, they issue scrip, and you can become an owner by buying a share. And that's how they raise their capital that way. And that's why they haven't moved out of Green Bay, by the way. Not exactly a huge market, but they can't move. Why can't we replicate that elsewhere? I think now's the time to ask those kind of bigger picture questions.
Your book looks at sports washing, and for British Columbians, for Vancouverites who have watched the matches unfold and the scenes on the streets unfold, they've seen sports washing in action. Qatar played in Canada's first match at BC Place Stadium, and the kingdom, which is rich in natural gas, sent about 1,000 people, paid for by the emir, hotel rooms, tickets, all expenses paid. They were out in the streets in force, waving their flags. There was also the military from Qatar landing at Vancouver International Airport with very large military transport planes, also in Abbotsford. It contained equipment, contained military vehicles, as well as personnel. There were Qatari paramilitary officers in uniform on the streets of Vancouver after the first match, and even after the match against Switzerland. I was able to get video and photos of them. They were embedded with the Vancouver Police Department and the RCMP, who are running security in Vancouver. This is a country that essentially bought by bribery, the 2022 World Cup hosting rights, and the country that is still in, or was in this tournament, qualified for this tournament, mainly because of the expanded 48-nation roster. They lost heavily to Canada. But this is also a country which Amnesty International has said that migrant workers continue to be vulnerable to labor abuses, exploitation, freedom of expression, and peaceful assembly continue to be tightly restricted. Religious minorities, women, children, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans people are continuing to face discrimination in law and in practice, and remained a leading exporter of liquefied natural gas, of course, for people concerned from an environmental standpoint. This is a country which has a lot of questions over it, a lot of questions hanging over it, yet is using FIFA World Cup and using soccer as a vehicle to try to change its image.
Yeah, and it's worked in Qatar. I mean, when they hosted the 2022 World Cup, it kind of worked. I mean, tourism has gone up in the country since the World Cup. They've fortified their position as a diplomatic force in the region. I mean, they're working on the deal between the United States and Iran right now, and alongside Pakistan. And so when people ask themselves, does sports washing work? They often mean, does it work on an international audience? And I think if the case of Qatar shows that it has worked on an international audience, I think with the case of the United States, it's a little bit different. I mean, when you're going down that list, by the way, Bob, like an exporter of fossil fuels, not a lot of rights, dwindling rights for, you know, civil liberties at home, increasing amount of repression against trans folks and others. That sounds a lot like my country, actually, right now, if I may say. And that's kind of one of the points that I'm trying to make in the book is that sports washing, a lot of people think it's just the thing that happens over there in Qatar, in Russia, in China. And it does definitely happen over there, but there's no reason that it couldn't happen in a place like the United States or Canada or France, where I happen to be right now, if you use the definition that I used before. The other thing is, since I'm in Paris right now, when I was hearing you talking, I was thinking back to the 2024 Olympics, where I was quite taken aback by the amount of foreign police in the streets here in Paris, policing with big long guns in the subways, you name it. This, what you're identifying, is a mega event tradition of sorts, where sovereignty, I guess, doesn't mean as much anymore. And you have people from other countries coming to police in these areas that they actually usually don't know that well in terms of the terrain. And so, but it's totally common for this to happen. I mean, we heard at the 2026 Milano Cortina Olympics, there was quite a kerfuffle over the fact that United States was sending the Homeland Security Investigations Unit of ICE over. And but hey, you know what? ICE has been going to the Olympics in foreign countries for a long time. The FBI has been going there at least since 2004. And so I'm not trying to minimize anything that we're talking about, but I'm saying it's also part of a longer tradition, as you know as well as anybody, Bob.
Speaking of countries in the Middle East and sports washing, another big one is Saudi Arabia, perhaps the biggest sponsor of FIFA through Aramco, their state energy company, oil company.
Saudi Arabia is a really interesting case because you're right. They have taken sports washing as a major public policy in the country. They've engaged in many different types, from funding LIV Golf, L-I-V Golf, which they've now dialed back on a little bit, to funding boxing matches, to actually buying a team in the English Premier League in Newcastle United, a form of settler colonial sports washing, if you will. And as you rightly noted, they're also gearing up to host the 2034 World Cup, which was just dropped in their lap by Gianni Infantino and FIFA with almost no discussion whatsoever and no real alternatives listed for 2034. Saudi Arabia is also interesting because it reminds us of what we were talking about before, the importance of economics in all this, because Saudi Arabia had loads of surplus capital that it had gained through its oil and gas industry. And in order to keep that capital productive, sports provides the perfect vector. You plug it in here, you plug it in there, you continue to keep your capital circulating at the same time that you're massaging and washing off your reputation in public. All of a sudden, you don't seem like you're that bad a place. So people start to forget about Jamal Khashoggi and that bone saw where they cut him apart in the embassy in Turkey. And instead, they're talking about Newcastle United in the upcoming World Cup. So Saudi Arabia is a really good example of how sports washing can happen as a policy. And Mohammed bin Salman was asked about it, and he says, yeah, I don't care. You can call it sports washing. Doesn't bother me at all. And so it's right out there. It is definitely happening. Another thing about Saudi Arabia 2034 is that means that sports washing is going to be a term that's around for a long time. So we might as well think about it with the complexity that it deserves now.
After 2010, we thought that we'd not see another mega event because the mega events cost so much here in Vancouver and the benefits are much lower than advertised and the social issues are never really solved and in some ways exacerbated.
It's kind of amazing to me, Bob, that the structural problems around sports mega events are very well known at this point. I mean, when you were unearthing a lot about the Vancouver Olympics in 2010, it was kind of a different era. There wasn't quite that level of public knowledge that there is today. But today, people know that the Olympics and the World Cup come with serious and chronic problems like overspending, like the militarization of public space and the intensification of policing that doesn't go back in the box and leave after the event. It stays and becomes part of the new normal, like gentrification and displacement, like greenwashing, like just straight up corruption. Like everybody knows now just about that the events come with that. And FIFA has really helped us by being such a sort of cartoon villain in all this and lacquering that extra layer on top. And yet cities and countries continue to bid for these things. That's for me because, you know, the fact of the matter is I have never in all my days studying this seen a bid come from the grassroots, from the people. It's always well-connected political and economic elites that want to use the event as a trampoline either for their own political careers or their own economic well-being or the economic well-being of their friends, and basically treat these events like their own private cash machine, you know, to just bring in all this public money and defray it out. Let's not forget the business model of FIFA and the International Olympic Committee is to privatize the benefits and socialize the costs. And so that means you and I as taxpayers in North America, Canada, and United States respectively, those we're paying those, so we're social part of the socialization of those costs. And yes, I think that there has been a lot of learning. And I don't know, maybe after this World Cup, because it's been so extreme and in your face, there'll be a few more scales that fall from a few more eyes. But at the same time, you know, FIFA has made it clear, as has the International Olympic Committee, that they actually prefer to deal with authoritarians. I mean, the former Secretary General of FIFA, Jerome Valk, said as much very directly a few years ago, because they don't have to worry about all these pesky questions that journalists in democracies like Bob Mackin can ask when they get them on the line. So I wish I had a better, more optimistic answer for you. But I will say this, Bob. There is a new campaign that people can get involved with. It's called Reboot FIFA. It's rebootfifa.com. And it's being put forth by a human rights group based in London called Fair Square. And Fair Square focuses on FIFA and its corruption and trying to reform soccer or football for everybody, for fans and for players and everybody. And so you can go to rebootfifa.com and you can sign on to what they're hoping is going to be the biggest ever class action complaint against FIFA in the history. They're going to bring that to the FIFA Ethics Committee, and they're also going to bring it to the European Parliament. And they're gathering all sorts of allies. There's good people like Lisa Klovnes at the Football Association in Norway, who's kind of moving in the same direction as this campaign. One of the few people inside the FIFA room has been willing to speak out. And so I think this is kind of an interesting campaign. I signed it. I should also probably mention I'm on the advisory council for this Reboot FIFA. And so I'm behind the scenes a little bit involved, but I think it's a good step. So I get the emails now that I signed the petition, and you get lots of good information about like next steps and then new things that have kind of come out in the news as the World Cup evolves. And I know sometimes fighting FIFA can just feel like an endlessly uphill battle, but there are little things like that that everyday people can do, not only to put their name on the line and try to help a little bit, but also to stay appraised of what's going on.
Well, thanks again for joining us on the Breaker.News podcast. Jules Boykoff, he is the author of Red Card, the 2026 World Cup, Sports Washing and the FIFA Greed Machine. And he is a professor at Pacific University in Portland, joining us from Paris. Thanks again to Jules.
Thank you, Bob. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 28th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Bookmark thebreaker.news and thebreaker.ca. Follow on social media. We're on X, Threads, and Blue Sky. Follow the YouTube channel for The Breaker videos. And sign up for the free email newsletter, bobmackin.substack.com. Become a paid subscriber. Get early access to podcasts. Thanks again, and until next week.